Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, a feature on an extremely common and quite disabling condition, dizziness, and the fascinating lessons to be learned from ballet dancers who can spin quite happily and then move effortlessly into an unimaginably complex set of movements requiring supreme balance when you and I would be on the floor wishing we hadn't had dinner. How can ballet dancers help doctors and patients treat this illusion of spinning and movement which occurs when you haven't just been thrown around the stage by Mikhail Baryshnikov? Barry Seemungal is a neurologist at Imperial College London who specialises in dizziness and imbalance and has researched the ballet dancer phenomenon.
In clinic, I see patients with chronic dizziness, which means people who have had dizziness for months, sometimes years. And one way of treating these patients is to use a form of training, and this training we call vestibular rehabilitation, which is effectively a series of exercises that we use so that the patient's brain is retrained. And the key to understanding dizziness is to understand that it's not an ear problem, it's a brain problem. The brain is the most important balance organ. That's demonstrated by the fact that you can feel dizzy from visual stimulation. We've all experienced the situation of sitting on a train on a platform waiting to go off, and an adjacent train moves past you and you'll feel that you're moving. And this sensation of self-motion is not coming from the ear, it's coming from the eye, the input into the eye. And the brain has to make the decision, am I moving or is it the train moving? And usually the sensation of self-motion is transient because the brain comes to the conclusion that it's the train moving and not my train. When we provide this training for patients with chronic dizziness, stimulates not just the ear but also the eye.
What do you do?
It depends on the patient's symptoms. Some patients complain of feeling dizzy when they see things moving. This is best explained by, again, the understanding that the brain uses all available information to determine if we are still or if we're moving. If you can imagine, maybe someone has a problem with their ear, and the brain then thinks, sensibly, that the signal from the ear is unreliable. So what it then does is it says, okay, I'm going to pay more attention to the visual signal. And that makes sense to a point. If it places too much reliance on the visual signal, then even trivial visual motion or patterned visual stimuli can generate sensations of self-motion. An illusion of self-motion is really the definition of dizziness.
Essentially, the brain is too easily conned. It's not getting its data from enough sources.
Absolutely. It's got the weighting a bit mixed up.
And when you talk about the ear, you're talking about the inner ear, which has these canals, which, a bit like a gyroscope, tell you what your orientation is in the world.
Absolutely, yes. The problem here is that the brain is adapting to something, but in this case, it's not got it quite right. It's maladaptive. You may wonder, why would that happen? Why wouldn't the brain get it right? One answer could be that ecologically, if your balance system's messed up in the wild, you wouldn't last 5 minutes. You'd be eaten. For certain things like balance, keeping yourself on your feet, running away, these are critical functions. So evolutionarily speaking, if an organism, including humans, had a problem with their balance, even for a period of 1 or 2 or 3 days, your survival is seriously threatened. And I guess since we have not evolved that much over the last 10,000 years, we effectively carry with us the baggage of our evolutionary history. And the second thing is that we also live in a very alien environment. The modern world is not the world of the caveman. Moving vehicles, flashing lights, cinema, widescreen TVs, aeroplanes. This is not the caveman world.
All of which induce an abnormal sense of motion.
It's very challenging for the brain. For example, there's an illusion that we all experience, and you may not be aware of it, when we are accelerating down the runway in an aeroplane. When you're accelerating down the runway, you have two accelerations imposed upon you. One is always present, it's called gravity, and that's vertical. The other one is the acceleration due to the aeroplane. If you remember your high school physics, if you have two accelerations, one is horizontal to the earth, one is going down to the center of the earth. If you join those two up, you get a tilt. So the next time you're accelerating down an aeroplane, have a look down the aisle and you will see that the aisle is tilted. And that's an illusion. That's because the brain has not got it quite right. The brain has to decide, am I accelerating at some ridiculous acceleration, which is not sensible, or am I tilted? And comes to the conclusion, wrongly, that you're tilted.
So the brain picks up the vector.
It does, yeah, the brain does physics. And that fact is well known to aviators who get catapulted off the decks of aircraft carriers. The British aircraft carriers don't use steam catapults, but the Americans do. And I understand that they can accelerate a typical fighter plane from 0 to 200 knots in 4 seconds. So that's reasonably challenging.
That's a big tilt on your brain.
So if you imagine that you perceive as you fly off the or get thrown off the deck that you're tilted upwards, the natural response is to push your joystick downwards. And there have been accidents where people fly into the sea. So interestingly, I'm not sure if this is true. You might want to corroborate this with marine aviators, but I was told that they're not allowed to be catapulted off the deck unless they take their hands off the pilots, take their hands off the joystick and put them on the sides.
Keep the brain in order.
Well, it's a totally alien environment. Aviation particularly so, and over the course of the last 100 years, many a time human error has been a result of the interaction between the brain and trying to work out these various vectors.
So is chronic dizziness a bit like chronic pain, where you once had pain from something or other, like a low back injury? You don't have the injury anymore, but somehow the pain keeps on going. It's a very difficult thing to treat. Is that the same situation in dizziness? You've got this abnormal brain circuit running without any tumour or infection or injury causing it.
That's a perfect analogy, I think. Acute pain serves a purpose. It's telling you your arm is broken or your leg is in the jaws of a shark or something dangerous. Chronic pain serves no purpose. You're absolutely correct. Acute vertigo serves a purpose and tells you that your balance is in trouble and your life is at risk in the caveman era. But the brain being an amazing mechanism will suppress your dizziness if you lose function in the ear within a few days and continue to improve that sensation of dizziness over a few weeks. But it can run into trouble. If the brain doesn't quite get it right, you end up with this maladaptive situation where the circuits are not quite functioning properly. And this whole thing is made worse by our modern environment. It's all very challenging.
So that's been a long way to get back to the ballet dancer and the brain training that you give people with chronic dizziness.
Yep. We were interested in looking at the brain mechanisms underlying training involved in suppressing dizziness.
And of course, famously, ballet dancers are supposedly trained to flick their eyes as they're going round to keep their eyes fixed on one spot.
We essentially took a group of individuals who are known to be resistant to dizziness, ballet dancers, and we hypothesized that this was related not to some innate born with capacity, but something that was related to their training. So what we simply did was we had 2 sessions with all the subjects. We tested their ability to feel dizzy, and also we tested the ear and lower brain function during spinning by measuring eye movements. And then in a second session, we scanned their brain. Now, there's variability in the amount of dizziness one feels, or the amount of dizziness you see in the eye movement response, and there's variability in the brain structure. So you can link this variability statistically, and you can then make links between function and brain structure. The first thing that we found in the 2 groups we tested, and we tested 49 people, they were all women, they were all right-handed. We wanted to control between the 2 groups, and they were all in their early 20s.
And why does the handedness matter?
There is literature to suggest that processing of balance signals in higher brain areas might correspond to if you're right-handed or left-handed. We just wanted to remove that extra factor out. So we had 2 very well-controlled groups. The second group, I forgot to say, were all female rowers, high-level rowers. So they were all quite physically fit.
So essentially you've got high-level ballet dancers, high-level rowers, all fit, all with the same handedness.
All women.
And you're testing their dizziness, their propensity to dizziness.
Absolutely. So the first thing we found was that, unsurprisingly, dancers' duration of dizziness following being spun round was much less than that of the rowers. And this was the case for the sensation of dizziness. So we measure their perception of dizziness by asking them to turn a little wheel. And it was also the case for the ear and lower brain function by measuring the eye movements. And that second function is what we call a reflex function, something that is processed by quite low-order brain mechanisms. In contrast, the sensation of dizziness, perception of dizziness, is what we would ascribe to higher-order conscious awareness-type brain processing. So we had these two aspects that we looked at. And for both aspects, the dancers showed less dizziness. So then we looked at the brain structure, and we found that in the dancers, an area in the cerebellum is an important part of the brain.
So this is the back of the brain, just above the neck.
Yes. It's very important for motor coordination, but also for processing signals from the ear. We found that in the particular part of the cerebellum that's important for processing balance, the grey matter would be the processing units of the brain.
As opposed to the white matter, which are the cables.
Absolutely, the connections. The grey matter in the area of the cerebellum responsible for balance control was smaller in dancers than non-dancers.
Of course, you'd think it would be like muscle more developed.
Yeah, that's right. But in fact, when we correlated how much grey matter there was with how experienced the dancer was, the more experienced, the smaller. So there seemed to be a relationship with how much practice they did. So how do you explain that? Well, the dancer never wants to feel dizzy. The other thing is dancers make movements that are always correct. They don't need to adjust. They are over-practiced animals. They practice for years and for hours every day. So when they make a foot movement or an arm movement or torso movement, they know exactly where they are and they are correct in their estimate of where they are. So they don't want feedback from sensory organs like the vestibular system telling them where they are. They just don't want it.
Because they already know.
They already know and they're right. So
when you say where they are, you mean their orientation in space.
Absolutely correct. So they know exactly where their body is in space and how its attitude is with respect to gravity and even the alignment with respect to the floor and the theatre, for that matter.
It'd be fascinating to know whether they see a tilt on the aeroplane when they take off.
I haven't asked. So they always want this. They do not want any flexibility. They just want a continuous suppression of the vestibular signal. And so they do this with less brain tissue, becomes more efficient. So they want a fixed tap, which is switched off. So this area of cerebellum...
They've essentially learned to shut it down. They trained it to shut down.
That's right. But we know it's not permanent, because one of the cohort of ballet dancers, about a year afterwards, became one of my patients. And so we had the unique situation where we had data from her when she was perfectly well and when she became ill.
With dizziness?
With dizziness, yes. She had a form of dizziness called vestibular migraine. In fact, she had a very dramatic presentation. She presented to our stroke unit in this hospital with what looked like a stroke, a sudden onset weakness down one side of the body. And the scans were negative, but then a few days later she started developing dizziness. And a few days later, dizziness with headaches, and she had classic migraine. Young female, typical person to have a migraine, and she developed vestibular migraine. And then she had this for several weeks, and I eventually saw her in clinic, and she'd stopped dancing, because whenever she spun round, she got dizzy. In fact, we retested all the parameters, and they were double the normal length for the perception. Interestingly, the reflex hadn't changed much. So these parameters, these things that change with practice, are not fixed forever. So getting back to the dancers, the interesting thing was that the structural changes in the cerebellum, the areas were different for reflex control and perceptual control.
So yeah. Perception is you think you're dizzy, and reflex is just responding in a way to it. So one reflex with dizziness is that your eyes beat. It's called nystagmus.
Yes.
Because you're dizzy, and when you look at the eyes, they're flicking from side to side.
That's correct. So the vestibular organ sends signals to various parts of the brain. One part is important for controlling the eye movement. So when you make a head movement very quickly, your eyes correspondingly shift in the opposite direction to the head, a bit like a Steadicam. So the visual world remains very stable. In fact, it can't be under conscious control because it moves the eyes within less than 10 milliseconds of your head movement. So you have the world rendered as very stable. It also provides some degree of reflex control for your posture. So these are things that we call reflex. But if you are with your eyes shut on a boat, and the boat is rocking, you can feel that rocking as a perception of rocking, and that's what we call perception and awareness. That's separate from the reflex function. So we found, in fact, that already at the level of the cerebellum, processing of the reflex coming from the vestibular organ in the ear was separate from processing of perception.
So it suppressed both the reflex and the perception of dizziness?
That's the interesting thing. Both measures were shorter in the dancers than non-dancers. But when we correlated reflex and perception in non-dancers, they were strongly correlated, makes sense.
So if you felt dizzy, your eyes were flicking.
Yeah, the more dizzy you felt, the more your eyes would flick. But within the group of dancers, there was no correlation between how long they felt they were dizzy and how long the reflex function was going on for. And so it just simply shows that when you train and adapt, the brain is flexible enough to change one aspect and not the other. And in fact, this is reflected in our patient who's now again a ballet dancer, who became ill. What happened was that her reflex function was not much changed, but when she became ill, what happened was the perceptual function was significantly affected. So measuring reflex function gives you one insight into vestibular balance function, but without knowing the perceptual processing and ways of measuring that, you don't have the full story.
Barry Seemungal, a neurologist and researcher into dizziness and imbalance at Imperial College London. And you're listening to The Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. The question is, where does all that get you, fascinating though it is, with better treatments for people who have a lot of trouble with dizziness? Ballet dancers, for example, are known to deliberately flick their head so that they're looking at one spot while they're spinning. But does that really help? Or is it just the repeated spinning in training and practice that makes the difference? Barry Seemungal again.
That's a good question, and there are two components to the answer. The first thing to say is that all the subjects were tested in the dark. So no one had the capacity or the chance to use what the ballet dancers called spotting to affect either the sensation of dizziness or the reflex function. The second thing is that spotting is a very sensible strategy if you're being spun around for long periods of time. That's because the fluid in the inner ear will start spinning separate from your head if you continuously spin around without stopping. So we call that a low frequency movement. A low frequency movement would be spinning continuously for 10 seconds. What spotting does is it chops up that low frequency into high frequency. So imagine I'm pirouetting, and trust me, I can't pirouette. Imagine I'm pirouetting for 20 seconds. If every half a second I make a quick head flick, then I convert that 20 second long rotation into multiple half a second rotations. And if you have quick, short, brief flicks, then the fluid can't get going. It remains still. It's the fluid which starts spinning different to your head movement that causes the dizziness. So it is a very sensible strategy. However, the fact that we test all the subjects in the dark shows that the dancers also have an inherent capacity to suppress dizziness even when they don't have spotting available to them.
So how's that going to translate? Because you're going to try using sort of ballet dancer techniques to treat people with chronic dizziness. What are you actually going to do?
We are planning a study looking at how we can use ballet techniques or dance techniques in general, actually, not simply ballet, to treat chronic dizziness. The reason being that we found that there was an experience-dependent effect on the dizziness and the brain structure in the dancers. And so we wondered whether or not we could use that to try and train patients with chronic dizziness. There are a number of factors in favor of using dance. Dance is quite fun. It also involves physical exercise. We expect there to be an increased amount of motivation to do the exercises. This sounds rather banal. Having fun, being motivated, and physical exercise are things, amongst other things, that have been shown to enhance brain plasticity and learning. Now, we believe that vestibular training, like any other rehabilitation, requires brain plasticity and learning of some description for it to work.
So you get people chronic dizziness pirouetting and spotting.
Breakdancing even. We don't expect any patient, unless they already had dance training, to achieve any degree of proficiency. They don't need to be doing ballet pirouettes. The important thing is they do need to be making head movements quite early on. And we will use ballet movements and also non-ballet movements to help us train these patients.
You've had a look at how accurately doctors who are not neurologists diagnose acute dizziness.
Well, we've got some experience in our hospital, just in our local referral centre. And on average, the teams that refer dizzy patients to us from the emergency room are correct in about 15% of the cases.
1-5?
Yes.
That's not very high.
Dizziness is a minority sport amongst doctors. It really is.
It's not amongst patients, but it's quite a common symptom.
The difficulty with dealing with dizziness is that it requires a knowledge of the physiology behind how the brain processes signals from the balance organ and from the eyes, and also our balance with the legs and the rest of the body. And that's not information that's widely taught in medical school. It's not to say that it's particularly difficult, it's just never been very popular. Having said that, the amount of physiology that we know about the system is a reasonable amount, and fitting it together does take quite a bit of time. Myself, I learned my clinical approach to vertigo and seeing patients with dizziness during my PhD. I remember it did take me at least a year and a half to actually understand how to approach patients with dizziness. And that was me spending most of my time looking at such cases. So I think the amount of time you need to spend to really understand the approach is beyond what the average doctor in another specialty would be able to spend. I guess it's akin to asking me to do an operation on your knee. I would have no
clue. But it is important, because there are some quite sinister causes of dizziness and acute dizziness. And when we're talking about vertigo, are vertigo and dizziness the same thing?
Excellent question. Because my clinic, the first thing I start off with is semantics. Dizziness means stupid in Old English. Vertigo, the word comes from vertere, which means to turn in Latin. So does it mean that to have a spinning sensation is the only thing that you really should pay attention to? The answer is no. There have been many studies with electrodes being put into patients, human patients, undergoing neurosurgery, often for removal of tumours or brain tissue causing epilepsy. And if you stick an electrode in the correct place, you can provoke a sensation of spinning. There's one particular case report in which, when they had the current down on low, the patient felt a slight rocking. And they turned it up a bit stronger, they felt slight tilt. And higher again, they felt they and the bed and the room were spinning. And importantly, they did not have any reflex response. There was no, as we say, nystagmus. It was just pure perception of, in this case, vertigo. But simply, in this case, the vertigo was a severe form of the rocking dizziness. So it's not so straightforward as saying only spinning counts and only rocking, or rocking is not relevant.
But they're on a spectrum, aren't
they? They're on a spectrum, yeah. And so when a patient presents with a severe case of dizziness, it's usually, but not exclusively, spinning.
But coming to the importance of diagnosis, a stroke can cause this.
Stroke can cause this. A stroke can present with just dizziness, spinning, vertigo often. And this is what makes it difficult for the non-expert, because the commonest cause of vertigo is not a stroke.
The commonest cause is something called benign positional vertigo, where you've got a little crystal or bit of rubbish in your inner ear.
Yes, about a third of patients in our little audit, if you like, a very small sample in our hospital, about a third of 90 patients had this benign positional vertigo, which is crystals in the inner ear, which you can make a diagnosis in about 5 minutes and treat another 5 minutes. And usually those patients should be home within 20 minutes. But the difficulty for the non-expert is that they can't distinguish between different diagnoses. So if 1 in 20 patients presenting with severe spinning dizziness or vertigo, as you want to call it, might have a stroke, then they're left with the decision, which patient do I scan? Which one do I send home? So it becomes very difficult.
And expensive.
Difficult, expensive, potentially dangerous for the patient. Really, the answer is you need to have at least a small group of experts in a major hospital or major centre to deal with this. Otherwise, the non-experts can never really quite attain the level of expertise required, because they don't see the patients regularly enough and they haven't undergone the training.
So what you're saying here is that there aren't a simple set of questions you can ask as to whether or not you've got an infection in your inner ear or a stroke.
There are some questions you can ask, and there are some what I call red flags. The more expert the doctor, the more efficient they can be at ascertaining which patients need investigation or not, or what treatment they need. You can have a set of screening questions. For example, if a patient presents with severe vertigo and new onset headache, then it could be a migraine, but it could be equally a stroke in the cerebellum, can present with headache and acute vertigo. So there are some red flags that the doctor can use, and we have written some criteria in the past to suggest people follow this.
What are the other red flags in dizziness?
Well, if a patient presents with acute vertigo and hearing loss on one side, that's a red flag. That might suggest, oh, well, it must be an ear problem. Yes, but the reason why it's potentially a red flag is that a particular type of stroke affects a particular blood vessel that supplies the ear for both balance and hearing function, but it's a branch of an important artery that supplies the brainstem and cerebellum. So if that artery is blocking off, it could start with presenting with hearing loss and vertigo from the ear, but then next starts affecting the brain. So this is a tricky one. You can see how a patient could present as if they have a peripheral non-brain problem, but then it can then start involving the brain.
How do you diagnose benign positional vertigo?
You need a couch, first step. If you go see a doctor for dizziness and they don't have a couch, you're never going to make that diagnosis. The history is the first thing, as ever. Patients with benign positional vertigo will complain of spinning vertigo, typically when they lie backwards in bed, not sitting up, backwards, and when they turn over. Just to clarify that, they will often also complain of dizziness when they stand up or look up or bend down, but you can't quite easily distinguish that from problems with blood pressure. So if you stand up quickly, we've all experienced feeling woozy because the blood isn't quite getting to the brain. But the critical question is to ask, do you get dizzy in bed because there's no blood pressure challenge? And do you get it when you lie back and turn over? That's the killer question, if you like.
So when you examine them, you get people to lie back?
You examine them by tilting them backwards with the head looking to one or the other side. And you look very carefully at the eye, because if they have an episode of benign positional vertigo, you will get a very strong, typically strong nystagmus.
It's a flicking of the eye.
Flicking of the eye. The eyes tend to rotate slightly, and that typically lasts about 10 or 15 seconds. And there are characteristics of this nystagmus that an examining doctor should be able to identify, not only confirming this is benign positional vertigo, but which particular canal that the problem is in, and therefore give the appropriate treatment for that particular canal.
Which is a sharp movement to shake out the crystal.
It's a movement, yeah. Not too sharp, but just enough. So the commonest canal is the posterior canal, and therefore the commonest manoeuvre one can use is either the Simont manoeuvre or the Epley manoeuvre. That covers 90% of cases. So I think that's... I do believe that benign positional vertigo, being so common, should be something that general practitioners should look for, should be able to diagnose and should be able to treat, and should know when it's not quite right. And those, there are some red flags there, and therefore they should seek help.
Barry Seemungal, a neurologist and researcher into dizziness and imbalance at Imperial College London. I'm Norman Swan, and this has been The Health Report. You can hear more by downloading a podcast from RN's website. Meantime, I'll see you next week.